Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 118 of Registry Matters. Larry. It's Saturday night. What's up, buddy?
118. That's almost my age.
Come on, we got a long way to go. We need to like use the new math to get to your age.
Well, 118 is close.
It's close. I mean, it's closer than 170.
I heard that it's a beautiful sunny day on the eastern seaboard.
It was gorgeous today, actually. I was having an email conversation with someone that lives downstate from me, and he asked me, "Hey, can you remind me again what FYP stands for?" And I tried to get him to, you know, I prod him with some clues. And here are some of the responses that he gave to me. And he said, find your protocol, fix YouTube pheasants, forget Yosemite, patents, F the people, F the pigs, ferment your peanuts, find young pink people was another one that you came up with. And can we go over what FYP stands for again?
It stands for if someone knocks at your door with a clipboard and says, I'm making a list of who's living in this residence. Because the public claims when it comes to the sexual offender registry, they have a right to know. And I said, well, really? Where does that right derive from? Why don't you start going around the neighborhood and asking people who's in a particular dwelling and find out what their reaction is? And that's where FYP comes from.
Now, obviously, you have to use the initials FYP when thinking about your answer, because you could just say, no, I'm not telling you. That doesn't fit FYP for sure. Charles says free yogurt people.
There's a lot of things that people assert that they have the right. And that's one right that I cannot find that there's any basis to support such a right that you have. There's no such right to know who's in a dwelling.
Can we stretch the definition of something of right? Can we scale the word back a little bit? Like, do you deserve to know who lives next door?
Well, that would be a more reasonable question. Shouldn't we be allowed to know? And of course, that the answer to the should you be allowed to know would be whether it violates any right of the person or the family who is in the residence. And I would say it does, because presumably there is a right to privacy in the U.S. Constitution.
And that would be the Fourth Amendment, as I recall, correct?
I don't know the numbers.
Do you really not know the numbers?
Nope, I don't keep track of trivial things like which amendment does what.
Okay, well, if the third one is the most important one, because that says that the government cannot quarter soldiers in your house without compensation or period, something like that. They can't force you to hold soldiers in your house. So that's the most important one.
Well, of course it is.
All right. And then did you know that we released a YouTube video Wednesday morning?
I did know that, and it has had splendid success. I think that should tell us that the people much prefer to see the person in that YouTube video versus listening to us babble every week.
Well, I don't know that that's true. I mean, it was much, much shorter. This is a shameless plug that this is going to be something that we're going to try and push forward with and hear and do some sort of content every couple of weeks.
Well, I think it's that sexy, handsome presenter of the video that makes all the difference.
I have no idea what you're talking about. I thought that was you.
No, I wouldn't fit in that category. I go back to Civil War times.
You're old and crusty. Do you remember the TV show The Crypt Keeper on HBO? Or I'm sorry, Tales from the Crypt, and then they had the character The Crypt Keeper?
I do not.
Okay, never mind. There was, old and crusty, like coming out of a coffin. Like anyway, never mind. We should move on. Larry, did the Supreme Court rarely steps in and delays or even stops an execution from occurring, but they did this in Alabama. They at least delayed it for a period of time. I think we talked about this guy at least a week, if not 2 weeks ago, that was accused and convicted of being present at some kind of nastiness and then actually ended up getting convicted of it. And then he was scheduled for execution. I think I have that right.
I believe this is the case we talked about, but unfortunately, as I predicted, the executive of Alabama didn't provide any relief, nor did I expect her to. And then the Supreme Court, these days, since the death penalty is not unconstitutional, and I'll even go a step further, it's not unconstitutional to execute an innocent person either.
That's bizarre.
Well, you have the right to life, liberty, and property, and not to be deprived of those things without due process. If you've had due process, they can deprive you of any of those things, including your life.
Because regardless of if you're innocent or not, if you had due process, you can take any of the aforementioned things.
That is correct. They can take your property with due process. They can take your life with due process.
What about eminent domain? I'm just throwing that out there. Just, you know, they want to move a highway through your neighborhood and they use eminent domain to move you out. That's not due process.
Sure it is.
Is it?
There's a process. They don't just come in and take a bulldozer. I mean, they negotiate with you for your property, and then they go through a process to take your property. But you do get compensation. There's a process to value the compensation, to provide some reasonable value to the property. You may not agree with it because it may have been in the family for hundreds of years, and you may not want it to. But they do. They don't take your property without any due process. But the greater good trumps. If you let one person hold up the entire progress, what kind of society would we have? All the things that would not have been built if one recalcitrant party who didn't want to sell was able to stand in the way.
So this individual had his life taken, though he may have been, at least he didn't commit the actual crime of killing anybody, but he was present and highly involved, and ultimately, they delayed it for a brief period of time, but then they eventually went forth and executed him last night, night before last? I forget which one.
Thursday night. Well, he didn't accept the plea deal that was offered that would have spared him the death penalty because his attorney told him that they could not secure the conviction they did. His attorney misinformed him. And that was the case I talked about, and I put a copy in Dropbox about when the attorney is wrong, that should have spared him, but the Supreme Court didn't see it that way, and I didn't follow the nuances close enough to know why they rejected his petition. But the Supreme Court for the last 25 years has it's grown more conservative. They used to intervene in death penalty cases a lot more than they do now, but since the death penalty is in fact constitutional, and we've had Justice Scalia explain it time and time again why it's constitutional, it's something we're going to have to change by policy. We can't expect the black robes to come in and save us from something. So when Alabama gets tired of executing people, they'll have to change their law. We did a long number of years ago, more than a decade ago here. I think it was 2009, so that's like 11 years ago. And Colorado just joined us, which is supposed to be so much more progressive state. They just joined this year in 2020.
And as far as that goes, it would be for us, the people, to decide that we're going to vote for people to represent us that would put forth the policy that says we're not going to execute, fill in the blank after that, a complete prohibition on it, or start going down, you know, people with mental deficiencies, or, you know, even people like Nathaniel Woods, etc. That would be on us, the people, to put the people in place so that we don't continue to perform these practices. Alabama has not done that yet.
They have not. And I don't expect they will anytime soon, because that's not what the people of Alabama support. People of Alabama believe fervently in the death penalty. They believe, and even in Georgia as well.
Yeah.
If you were to take a poll of Georgia, I would say that the death penalty is overwhelmingly supported. It's, by golly, he took a life, and now the right thing to do is to take his life.
I don't like it, Larry. I do not like it. Should we move over to the appeal?
I think so, but this is one of those things where Alabama perhaps will join the family of civilized nations at some point.
And Alabama will join civilized nations. Well, that's a funny way to present
the U.S. hopefully, but see, you can't have the U.S. join the civilized nations on that, because the U.S. federal government can't set the policy for the states. They can only decide that we're not going to have a federal death penalty, which we do have right now, but if we were to abolish the death penalty at the federal level, all the independent sovereigns within this country can still have their own death penalty. So that's why I said the family of nations, because we can't do it at the national level. The states have their right to prescribe their penalty schemes.
We would have to do a constitutional amendment to make that something that can't be done at the states. Is that how that would work out?
Well, I mean, theoretically, we could amend the U.S. Constitution to proscribe a prohibition on the death penalty, but the constitutional amendment process is so cumbersome.
Oh, yeah.
I don't see that happening.
No, I don't either, but is that the only remedy that the nation could decide to do to force Alabama to stop?
That would be the only remedy, or else you could put a bunch of liberal activists legislating from the bench judges on who could interpret the Constitution to invent something that the framers weren't thinking about, a prohibition, or you could put people on the court who believe in that evolving standards of decency that we're going to hear from Scalia in a little bit.
I was just going to say, we have something about that later. We haven't decided where we're going to play, though, so I guess we can wait till the end.
That could be a good place. This would be a good place to play his evolving standards of decency.
All right, then we will jump into... yes, here we go. All right, so here is Scalia that I titled "The Constitution That I Apply Is Not a Living, But It's a Dead Philosophy," or something like that. All right,
we played this before about 6 months ago.
Oh, did we? Oh, I made a new clip for it then.
Yeah.
The Constitution that I interpret and apply is not living, but dead. Close quote. Explain that one.
Much of the harm that has been done in recent years by activist constitutional interpretation is made possible by a theory which says that, unlike an ordinary law, which doesn't change, it means what it meant when it was enacted and will always mean that. Unlike that, the Constitution changes from decade to decade to comport with, and this is a phrase we use in our Eighth Amendment jurisprudence, we, the court does, to comport with, quote, the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society. In other words, we have a morphing constitution. And of course, it's up to the court to decide when it morphs and how it morphs. That's generally paraded as the, quote, living constitution. And unfortunately, that philosophy has made enormous headway, not only with lawyers and judges, but even with John Q. Public.
I still have to think that there is reasonable thoughts behind both philosophies of toeing the line and not letting anything move, and then also changing the way that our vocabulary is interpreted to let things be interpreted the way they would be today under our standards of living.
Well, absolutely. That's why brilliant legal minds disagree. I mean, I agree with Scalia when we played the clip last week that, you know, dead was dead then and dead is dead now. We have no disagreement about that.
Yeah, there's not much to change in the standards of that.
Where we would differ is that I would say that the knowledge that I would agree with what Breyer said about that the Constitution was enacting a value system of what decency would look like. And as we've learned over the last 240 years, we didn't know the evolution of the brain and how well developed the mental capacity of a particular age group was, or what diminished capacity looked like. So at the time that they drafted that beautiful document, they didn't have the understanding what they have to do. But dead is certainly still dead, no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. But would those people, having the understanding that they have today, would they have not gone ahead and done that? Well, that takes a lot of predicting what they would have done had they known stuff that we know now that we don't know then, that we didn't know then. But I tend to think that these decent human beings would have not wanted to execute people if they had the understanding of the development of the human brain at the time they drafted that document. So therefore, I would say that it evolved with our knowledge as our knowledge evolved.
Then why the standards of decency. Put together amendments, whatever the process might there be, to say that you can't execute, you know, a minor, you know, pick whatever subject you want. Felony jaywalking, you can't execute people for felony jaywalking. And we could make the constitutional amendment to do that.
We could, but that's an exceedingly difficult process with what has to happen to amend the Constitution. It takes a huge supermajority, and it's not an easy process.
And then ratified and by two-thirds of the states or three-quarters?
Three-fourths of the states. And it's hard to get three-fourths of our states to agree on things.
Anything. What time the sun rises. I mean, we're not going to be able to get them to agree. I don't think we could get them to agree on anything, practically. All right. I don't know that I can ask you any more intelligent questions about what he's talking about.
All right.
And you've left me again.
I'm right here.
Oh, there you go. Okay, you're back. What other intelligent questions can I ask you about Mr. Scalia?
Well, he's a brilliant man. So there's a lot to ask about him. Well, these clips are not intended to demean Scalia at all.
No, I get
these
that.
Clips we play of Scalia is intended for the people who out there who are ardent fans of that type of judicial interpretation, just to let them be more enlightened about what we would have if we had a majority on the court who felt that way, which I think now we have close to a majority who feels that way. But that doesn't diminish his brilliance. I mean, he makes completely rational arguments for all of his positions.
I definitely agree with that, but that doesn't mean that RBG or anybody else is any less brilliant. We just have tons and tons of clips, and he's very charismatic and entertaining to listen to. He gets kind of snarky and whatnot, and gets the audience to laugh and go along with him.
He does indeed. He's always, for the whole time he was on the court, he was one of the one who was most charismatic, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg about as dull as you can find. So from the progressive side, there's really not anybody that I would feel is fun to play their clips, because what they say just isn't as charming. I mean, what Breyer said when we played his quote last week, it made sense, but it was a lot less charismatic the way he presented how persuasive he was with his position.
So, you know, so we had 13 states. I don't know if that's how many it was when all of that stuff was ratified. Ultimately, it wouldn't be nearly as hard to try and coalesce 3/4 of 13 states versus 3/4 of 50 states, which I know some people think it's 52, but whatever, we can talk about those another time. If it is such an arduous process to try and get it done, is there then something to be said on both sides of it should be arduous to get it to be done versus maybe it's too cumbersome and that in itself should be adjusted to make it so that we could adjust it ever so slightly easier than what it is now?
I'm not convinced that making it easier to amend the Constitution is all that wise, because the easier you make it, the more you have the potential for mob rule,
mm-hmm.
and for decisions to be made based on motion. We have all the power we need right now, and I agree with Scalia on this. If you don't like the death penalty, do what they have done across the country in the states that have eliminated it. You have the power. There's nothing that requires you to execute anybody for any offense. The Constitution doesn't require capital punishment. It's your choice whether or not you want capital punishment. Simply choose another course of punishment for criminality other than the death penalty.
And that means getting out there and evaluating a candidate and possibly directly asking them questions about how they feel about XYZ and making an informed decision, not just based on what you see on the television and watching attack ads against the opponent.
That's unfortunately how most decisions are made. We vote based on the charisma of the candidate, and we vote against people because of the stuff I heard that Obama uh-huh. did this. I heard that Trump did that. I heard this and I heard that. And then you start asking about the policy ramifications. They can't even explain to you what their policies are, much less the ramifications of their policies. The average person that supports a candidate, you'd have a difficult time getting them to explain what policies really inspire them. When I've talked to some close friends of mine that I've known for decades that are strong Trump supporters, the most common thing is, I like the way he talks.
Mm-hmm.
I like the way he talks.
mm-hmm.
And I said, really? You like the way he talks? That's it? What about his policies? Well,
Don't care.
I'd rather not hear. Obama went around the world apologizing for U.S. I didn't like that. And I like Trump says the United States is right. And I said, well, what about his policies? Do you agree with? And I can't. I said, you go round and round. And it's a charisma thing. I mean, they're attracted to Trump because of whatever characteristics that they like about him. But very few will get into a deep policy discussion about what policies are appealing. I said, and I try to guide the discussion. I say, well, do you agree with his lock him up and maximum penalty? Well, no, I don't agree with that. Okay. You start down the list. No, I don't agree with that. Do you agree with relaxing the environment? Well, no, I do want to try to keep. And I said, well, do you agree with cutting the people off Social Security disability? Well, no, I don't agree with that. But yet they still. I said, well, this makes no sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, you could equally say Elizabeth Warren is very charismatic, and Bernie certainly has a shit ton of support behind him. I mean, he's got a crazy number of people that follow him. Maybe they're, I don't know, I don't want to say that they're more or less involved in the policies, but both of them are very charismatic.
Well, I think on Bernie, I don't know what it is, if I'd call it charismatic, but Bernie sounds like he's angry every time he opens his mouth to me.
He does. I agree.
He sounds like he's mad continuously, and he doesn't have there's a killer instinct in politics where you have to pounce, and he frequently lets his prey off the hook, like he did with Hillary back about the emails in 2016. He let her off the hook, this is a tough business to be in, and he's destined to collapse, I think, because he doesn't have that, and he just is not a likable person. Trump said this week, and I got a cackle out of it, because he said that what a likable person. They were asking him about Elizabeth and why her campaign collapsed, and of course one reason, she's a fibber, but so is Trump.
Fibber is to put it politely to say that about Trump.
But I don't have no problem calling out somebody on my side either. I mean, sure. she has difficulty telling the truth. I mean, I can't keep track. I mean the native blood, and then she got fired for being pregnant, I think was another one. Trump said that she's just not likable. And then he says, contrast to me, I'm very likable. Well, I'm not so sure, but apparently he is.
Hey, I wonder the Bernie thing, do you have some sort of accent bias that you don't like that he's from New England and he talks funny?
No, it's the anger that he just oozes, that he's mad continuously.
Yes, I know. I'm just picking. Yeah, I'm just trying to poke fun because he says words kind of funny, you know, with the New England accent.
He doesn't come across as warm at all.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And again, you shouldn't vote because someone is warm and fuzzy. That shouldn't be the only characteristic and the only standard. But if all else is equal, I tell people when I was in the hiring business, if I had to make a decision between candidates and they were roughly equally qualified and I liked one because they had a warmer, more bubbly personality, I'm certainly not going to hire the one that I don't like if everything is roughly equal. Same thing with voting. If someone is warm and likable, and I agree with more of their policies, I'm going to vote for that one over the person that sounds like they're angry and mad continuously. So,
all right. Well, then let's move on over to the appeal that I tried to do a minute ago before we got hijacked to go over Scalia. For many serving harsh sentences, the governor becomes a last hope. These are people that get sentenced to crazy long sentences, and they have no relief except for to get the governor involved. And I know that it doesn't happen that often, at least from my understanding. And they profile a woman who got a crazy amount of time. It looks like, I think she was just like an accomplice, like almost like forced to not quite do drug deals, but almost be like the driver, and got a massive amount of time for being involved in a big crime. And to try and get some sort of relief, trying to go to the governor to get that all, get out of prison.
Well, that's the flaw with the system. The majority of the states, your state actually has a better system than most, where they you don't appeal to the governor, you appeal to the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles, which is largely insulated from the mob rule. But when you have the executive being the last resort, where you've put these mandatory sentences in place that if they have a prior record and whatever generates the mandatory, if you have where a person has to be sentenced to a harsh period of time imposed upon them by the court without any discretion, then the last resort would be, because cruel and unusual punishment, we covered that last week in terms of what cruel and unusual punishment is. If the electric chair is not cruel and unusual,
yeah,
a long sentence is probably not either. And we end up with people appealing for executive clemency. Well, that's a political office. People that run for governor, I can't think of any state that where they don't elect their governors. And if you start turning too many people loose, you end up with a massive amount of blowback. And that's why Governor Blagojevich didn't turn anyone loose. He just let them stack up on his desk for his entire term of governor.
Or they do it like presidents do it in the lame duck session.
Well, it does tend to be when there are a plethora of them. Granted, it tends to be like a governor on the route that doesn't have political ambitions. You'll see on the route, Governor Ryan in Illinois did quite a few. He did that. He commuted. I think he cleared off death row in Illinois when he left office. And you had Governor Haley Barbour down in Mississippi. He did a lot of people. I mean, that's kind of, but that's when you have the greatest freedom to do something. I mean, it's when you're not running again. But if you're going to run again for something, I mean, Huckabee in Arkansas, Governor Huckabee did that, and that hurt him in his presidential campaign because that was an issue made about how lavishly his born again Christian values, which he practiced when he cut sentences and let a lot of people out of prison.
Did he really?
Oh yes, he did.
And so who attacks him? But which side would attack him? He was running under the Republican ticket, so who would attack him for espousing those views?
The Republicans.
That doesn't make sense to me. Typically, I'm not saying by any, you know, they are generally on Team Red. The Christians are, so they would espouse those views. That makes no sense to me.
They didn't attack him for being a Christian. They attacked him for letting people that had not done their time out.
Yes, but
it wasn't because of his Christian. But he actually, my point was not to get Christianity into it. Actually practiced his Christian values of looking at a person and seeing that they had redeemed themselves. Christians frequently espouse that, but they don't actually practice it. Huckabee actually did.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm getting at.
Well, but the conservatives talk out of both sides of their mouth.
That's what I'm trying to reconcile. That's what doesn't make sense to me.
Well, but they do it all the time.
I understand that too.
Who do you think tried to derail the First Step Act? Was it the liberals from Cory Booker, or was it the conservatives led by Senator Tom Cotton in Arkansas that watered down? Who watered down the First Step Act?
According to somebody else I had an email thread with recently, had no idea that that's how that went down. But yes, I totally know that the conservatives had watered it down, like you said.
Okay, but that's who attacked Mike Huckabee when he was running for president. That's who attacked Governor of Massachusetts that ran for president, Michael Dukakis, when he was running against Bush. He got Willie Horton all through that campaign in 88. Because Massachusetts had a furlough program, and Willie was let out on furlough and did some crime. I don't remember what it was, but he got Willie Horton.
I'm confused.
It's not the liberals that attack for this stuff. It's the conservatives who attack on this stuff.
Yes, I do understand.
The liberals.
I do.
The liberals will attack on other things, but not for. Yeah. I tell people, when you say a liberal that's attacking a conservative for being softer on crime, please send that to us so we can get that on the air, because it doesn't happen.
Very well. Let's move over to another article from The Appeal. And this is about a podcast. And actually, there's a transcript listed, but it says Justice in America, episode number 22, Probation and Parole. Hey, kick-ass episode. I only made it about halfway through there. But can you remind me what the stats were between like the national average and then a particular state in what their probation rate was?
Well, the national average, according to this, was 1,300 per 100,000 people under supervision controlled. And it said Georgia is at 5,300.
So that's like four and a half times more people. And this is on probation and parole. On average, is 1,300 per 100,000 people. But in Georgia, it's 5,300. That is a lot of folks under the Department of Community Supervision, as they renamed it here these days. Wow.
Well, and it would make sense if Georgia had a very low incarceration rate, but Georgia has a very high incarceration rate.
They must be just super criminal here in this state. There's just constant criminality all around. And you know, the schmuck governor that we've got now, he is all about making an enhanced some sort of bill dealing with gangs and whatnot. They're almost going to make gang activity get registered as sex offenders. I don't think I'm exaggerating too far in that description.
I don't see a problem with that, Andy. The more registered, the better, according to what some people say.
Well, the more of us that are registered, then the less of us that are actually like registered. I don't actually see there being something wrong with that logic, other than obviously everybody being registered.
Well, depends on what the requirements of the registration are. If the requirements impede your liberty after you paid your debt to society, it's wrong, no matter what.
Did you listen to the episode?
I did not. I just did a skim read through it because it's such a long article. The Appeal always goes on and on, and this is a podcast, but anything they publish goes on and on.
Especially in this case, since they have the transcription. I am going to take a quick breath. I am getting reports of me popping. Hopefully that fixed it. I haven't had popping in quite some time. So anyway, I would encourage you to go over and listen to it. And actually, if people are new listening to, new to being involved in the criminal justice system, it seems like this podcast might be a really good source just to this one. They brought up a key term. They had like a word of the week, whatever, and they were talking about the word community. And they use the word community to describe all kinds of things like the Department of Community Supervision or community policing. And they use that as, I guess, kind of like you use the expression kid gloves. It almost seems like they use this term to make, oh, hey, the police, community policing. This is a good thing, right? Yeah, but it's not quite what you think the way the term is used.
It is not.
But they go through that first, and then they start talking about how poopy the system is in general with the people's. But I would recommend you go listen to it. Possibly subscribe to that podcast, just the same as you should subscribe to this one. Hint, hint, wink, wink, nod, nod. Let's move over to an article from CNN Politics. Six former wrestlers say Representative Jim Jordan knew about abusive OSU. So that's Ohio State University doctor. Tell us what your problem is with this article, Larry.
Well, my problem is that we'll never know what Representative Jordan knew when he was a coach there and what he was brought to his attention. But I'm wondering if there is possibly a double standard in terms of the reaction to these allegations. If I read the article correctly, the doctor is now dead. But these young men are, well, they were young men at the time. They're now, some of them are well through in the middle age, but they're coming forward with what appears to be credible accounts of what the doctor was doing to them when they went to seek help from the team doctor, from the team physician. Wrestling's kind of a competitive sport, and there tends to be the potential for a lot of injuries and a lot of sprains and stretching and things that goes with the sport. And the doctor was notorious for examining the genitals of the young men who went for any reason whatsoever. And supposedly, according to the wrestlers that have come forward, it said that it was well known all over campus that it was kind of a hazing ritual for the incoming freshmen. And Representative Jordan, who was a coach, was this was reported to the representative, to the coach at the time, who's now a representative, and there was nothing done about it. And I'm just wondering if it's going to be very difficult to bring the person back from death to try him in a criminal setting. You know, so we won't get the outcome we got with Dr. Nassar with the gymnast. But if what is being reported by the wrestlers is the reaction of the people in authority, well, if he did this to me, I would just punch him out. I would snap his neck. I would do this and that. That's not a proper reaction. When you send your kids off to a university environment, and I don't have any kids, but I'm guessing that when you send them off, particularly if they've been recruited by the university, and this is a university where people are just delighted to sign up to play sports, whatever the sport is, on scholarship, I'm assuming that one of the things that you are concerned about as a parent is how well that university is going to try to protect your offspring, your kids.
And I certainly think so.
That you would say, it's kind of a hazing ritual around here, or he did that to me, I'd punch his lights out. That just doesn't seem like the right response to a person who's having their crotch grabbed because they are reporting a sprained ankle or a thumb or whatever that they're going in there for. This just seems so bizarre.
It says a former wrestler, forget the name, I don't want to say the name, says he immediately complained to Jordan when the doctor attempted to remove his shorts during an exam for a thumb injury. I'm not a medical professional of any sort, but you know, the knee bone's connected to the ankle bone, like all that whole thing that we learned back when we were kids. I don't really see what the relationship would be having your shorts removed and a thumb injury.
Well, I think you would certainly want to start with the thumb first, I'm guessing. I mean, maybe we need to have a doctor on here and find out if you would, where you would examine out from there, depending on the symptoms. But this reminds me of what was going on at Penn State University with Sandusky and the, what should have been a credible coach who said he walked in and found Sandusky on a young man. And that was a high schooler, not a college, but found him on a young man and reported that to Joe Paterno, who was his supervisor, who should have reported it to Graham Spanier, who was the president of Penn State, and nothing was done. Is there a gender inequality here? Do we not take these things serious because it's boys?
You probably, I was actually having a conversation today that seemed to, please don't send me any hate mail. But when we were talking about like being in the military and guys will be all rough and tough and, you know, they make crude jokes about things. And this is sort of related to the Michael Bloomberg and the NDAs about maybe off-color jokes or whatever. But as soon as a woman got put into the unit, and this is nothing disparaging about women, then the culture changed, the character changed. So I'm thinking that in the case of the male wrestlers, that what you would have is like, oh, you should toughen up, or don't be such a fill in the blank for whatever word you want to use there. You could take it and just suck it up. You're a man, do it. And maybe that would be the response. Like, here's just the, you know, here's what you have to do to make ends meet.
So, well, Russ Hellickson, who was a longtime wrestling coach there, and five former Ohio State assistant coaches who worked with Jordan previously issued a joint statement saying none of us saw or heard of abuse of OSU wrestlers. The well-being of our student athletes was all of our concern. If we had heard of any abuse, we would have spoken up. End of quote.
This still goes to, we have allegations. There's even like files that the Boy Scouts have had where, you know, like just report after report, but they're held like under lock and key in a safe or something like that. We have the report coming out from the priests in Pennsylvania. You have tons and tons of evidence coming out that different organizations almost have institutionalized, almost like mob activity of protecting this activity, that if just the lowly student makes an accusation, it is impossible for it to go anywhere. But at the same time, I absolutely want, and I think everybody would want, if somebody does something that is not appropriate, is breaking the law for sure, that they should be heard and the criminal justice system should get involved. I'm really conflicted on how to square those two ends. It seems like you have such power on either side that the Me Too movement may have gone too far, that you just say, oh, he made me feel squishy, and you go to prison. But then you also have these institutions that are protecting serial offenders.
Well, yeah, we'll never know. I mean, we've got the allegations, and I always presume that an allegation is just that until it's proven. It's going to be very difficult to play this out in a legal setting because of the deceased. But one wrestler, Mike Alf, an OSU wrestler from 88 to 92, previously told CNN there's no way Jordan would have known about this and not intervened. And his point was that the doctor never came on to him that way. Well, I mean, that in and of itself is not any conclusion, because doctors amazingly are humans, and they find certain body types more attractive. It could be, if you looked at the profile of the accused, of the wrestlers who are accused, it may be that he preferred smooth bodies over hairy bodies. It may be he preferred pint-sized guys over large guys. We just don't know. But we can't say, because it never happened to you, that somehow invalidates the allegation. The fact that he might have been professional and proper, it may mean he just did not find you attractive.
Very bizarre. Very bizarre.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
We got, Larry, this article is absolutely amazing. This is from The Hill, and it says, ridiculous laws are a symptom of America's overcriminalization problem. I had to subscribe to this Twitter feed. You'll find a link in the show notes for this. And some of these laws are the funniest things I can ever imagine that we have. And I've heard, I guess, is the term blue law, is that a term you're familiar with?
I am indeed. That would be something from your part of the country.
Okay, so specifically to the Southeast?
Well, not specifically, but more common.
Okay. My understanding of what a blue law is something that was put on the books when you were a child, and it's just left there, you shall not eat chicken on Wednesday nights or some stupid thing like that. And then it just never goes away, which would bring up an argument that we should have laws that automatically sunset, if not renewed. But here's a whole Twitter feed that releases, like daily, it releases stupid laws. Some of them are funny, and I have one in mind. I don't know that I should repeat it, but it says, I'll do this one. It says, U.S. Code 7414 says, make it a federal crime for an employee of the National Honey Board to reveal how a honey handler voted in a honey referendum. I don't know how somebody came up with the word honey in that sentence that many times. That on its own is pretty impressive. But how do we make a law that's like that? And how are you supposed to then, as a citizen, navigate your way around all of these laws? You have to navigate this like it's a minefield. It's crazy.
Fortunately, these laws are never enforced, seldom enforced. I shouldn't say never. But it's an example of we don't go back and repeal stuff. If you look at the laws that are compiled in most of our states, you'd find stuff that's so outdated, but it's never been repealed. No one thinks about enforcing it. But the blue laws, as I recall them, had to do with Sunday sales and Sunday things that were prohibited from being done on Sunday. And the South was very common about that. But I just did a quick Google search, and there are other states outside the South. But growing up as a youngster in Georgia, in the small towns that I lived in, nothing was opened on Sunday back in the. You could purchase a meal. But most things were closed on Sunday, and as times have gotten more liberalized, more and more things are the laws themselves are not prohibiting businesses from opening, but you still have town pressure. Like if you went to a small town that believed that of the sanctity of Sunday, there wouldn't be a law enforcement ramification. But if you opened your pool hall on Sunday, you would get pressure from the town officials. You'd probably find your pool hall being inspected for a code violation, for any number of code violations, because we would prefer you don't open this pool hall on Sunday. This is not the type of business that we expect to see operating on Sunday. But I remember that there'd be one pharmacy in my hometown that would alternate being open on Sunday for emergencies, but all the pharmacies were closed. It's just such a list of things that were closed. You couldn't buy a car on Sunday. you couldn't do much of anything on Sunday. You could rent a hotel room if your town had a hotel, but practically every merchant was closed.
So you being like the policy expert that you are, have you ever heard the idea presented that laws should have some sort of sunset on them for them to then be renewed and reinstated? 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, whatever that. Have you ever heard of that idea being presented?
I have, and that is done from time to time. Particularly like the Patriot. Trump tax cuts. There've been other examples that the tax cuts were good for 10 years because theoretically we're going to watch the revenue and see that exactly what expected to happen. It was going to go through the sky, which it didn't. But there's ample times where there's a sunset on things where they have to be reauthorized or they die. But I'm not a big believer that is the magic cure-all, because you could be forced at a particular time to reenact a bad law because of the political whims at the time, and you get stuck with 10 more years of something, or maybe making it permanent. And the wiser public policy would have been to have let it die.
Yeah. I was almost thinking that you were going to go down the path of saying, oh my God, I'm having like an old person moment. I've lost my thought. Crap. Where did it go? Shit. I lost my thought, Larry. What'd you do with it?
You've got Alzheimer's.
Oh my God. You were going to bring up the specific point of you were going to say it. Damn it. I know what it was. We should. So if it's on the books, then the prosecutor could say, well, screw it. You can't eat with chicken with a fork on Wednesdays, and you ate chicken with a fork, so I have to prosecute you. You have to take away the tool from the prosecutor to not have the, they would never do it, but they could.
Well, that is something I believe. If the potential for prosecution is there, that is a threat that you would like to remove if that's a law that society no longer supports, because prosecutors are not always pure as wind-driven snow. And if you're looking for a reason to prosecute somebody, you could, if it's on the books, you can put your hand on the Bible and say, I'm doing what I was swore that I would do.
Yeah, I mean, you could use a scenario like an Al Capone kind of thing where they had to get him on tax evasion kind of things instead of the actual crimes that he was committing. So they, you know, I'm not saying that they bought up bullshit charges, but they had to go a very different way. So maybe you could get Al Capone for eating chicken with a fork on Wednesday and prosecute him under felony charges and send him to clink for his chicken eating habits.
Well, you might not send him to the clink, but what you might do is get more cooperation on what you're really trying to find out. The threat of prosecution would induce people to, you know, I may have the authority to send you to jail for 90 days, a maximum penalty for something silly as that. It's probably not a felony, but I may say, well, you know, if you want to come in, let's have a conversation about some things. You know, I think I'll hold off on these charges, but otherwise, it can be used as leverage.
And then moving on, we have a collection of articles talking about firing public defenders for various reasons. And the first article that we have up is from a man named Rory Fleming, and we had him as a guest. I don't know if you remember having him on as a guest, Larry. Do you remember? It was like episode 20?
I know. As a matter of fact, I don't recall that.
How about that? Well, you put this in there, probably not even intentionally grabbing the article from him, but it appears as though these individuals were fired for being in support of, and please remind me what they were writing an amicus brief in support of. I don't remember reading what it was.
It was for this and that.
Oh, this and that. Sweet. Filing an amicus brief challenging the constitutionality of cash bail is considered above and beyond the acceptable level of advocacy. So they were fired for this, and should they be treated something like teachers that get tenure or other, you know, other professions that end up with some kind of tenure so that they can be outspoken? They certainly have law degrees. They certainly have some level of expertise in working on the defense side. Maybe they should be protected from just being fired.
Therein lies the question. In this particular case, as our public defense systems have evolved in different directions around the country, we have a statewide systems where there's a unified command structure and they work for either the executive branch of the governor or they work for a commission. We've got a county by county system, which is the way Georgia does it, as far as my understanding. You know, each county is responsible for indigent defense. So if they hire an indigent, the county doesn't necessarily have to have a public defender's office. They can just appropriate money for contract attorneys, which is made available to the court to appoint people to represent folks. But if they hire a public defender, you do work for someone. And in this case, it appears that the Montgomery County, Pennsylvania Commission decided that it was no longer their pleasure to have Chief Dean Beer and Public Defender Keisha Hudson on their staff. So they terminated. So what do we do to preserve the independence of the Public Defender's Office, but yet have an employee-employer relationship? I mean, would you want a public defender that answers to no one?
But shouldn't they be, I mean, you used the word independent a minute ago, but shouldn't they be allowed, military people can't do any kind of, you know, they have to be very, very selective about being in parades or things of that nature, supporting XYZ cause. Should public defenders, being public employees, be restricted from what kind of advocacy work they are in or not in support of?
Well, I mean, they have every right to have their opinion about the monetary bail system, but the county commission said that that's inconsistent with our bail reform that we've done here and our pretrial release program. So therefore, we find ourselves at odds with you, and therefore, you're not our chief public defender anymore. Where's the line? I don't know. That I'm struggling with this also.
And I just want to say, so we had an article from Filter Mag, and then there's another one from the Philadelphia Inquirer, and then it looks like also from WBRC, prison reform package backed by Ivy promises bed. Oh, I don't think, no, that's a different article. Never mind. There's a Washington Post article that we needed to mention. A Pennsylvania county fired its two top public defenders for doing their jobs. So those are the three articles that cover that subject. I don't know, well, man. I'm trying to figure out which way to square that.
Well, it raises an interesting question. Yeah, up until just a few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, the public defender, our statewide system was under the executive branch, and each chief executive, each governor, appointed the chief public defender. And therefore, if you got yourself crossways with the chief executive, you'd find yourself on the outside looking in. Well, we realized that wasn't such a great system, so now they work for a public defender commission. But the commission also has its biases, and since we've had the commission, the first public defender they had hired has gone on to do other things, and so you have accountability in every job. What we're struggling with here is, where does free speech end? Where does your personal belief? How much of your personal beliefs can you put into a court pleading and expect it to have no ramifications on your job? I don't know the answer to that.
What about the notion, it was just hinted in here, what about the idea of having public defenders elected? Do you think that possibly having someone actually standing up there in front of the public saying, I support the full impact of due process and trying to vociferously defend people from accusations, does that even happen in the United States as it is?
Well, it says elections for the office of RARE, according to the law professor Ronald Wright, just 4 places elect public defenders: San Francisco, California, Lancaster, which is Lincoln, Nebraska, Davidson County, Nashville, Tennessee, and it says Florida. So I didn't know that Florida did that, if it's talking about the statewide. But can you imagine going out to a relatively ill-informed electorate and saying, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. If you elect me public defender, I am going to raise your taxes so I can have more, better lawyers, more investigators, more budget for expert resources, so we can fight the battle of forensics. And we're going to do everything we can to keep people from going to jail in this county. How many votes do you think that would pick up down in the county you live in if a person had to run for that office?
But the person that's running against him would then be going, I'm going to try and throw them under the bus as hard as I can. Like, so now we almost have like a double duty prosecution team. I'm just trying to come up with any idea on how to balance the scales, because the prosecution has all the money in the world. The defense side has not all the money in the world. And the people that are trying to defend have no idea what's going on. They have no idea how the process works, and they're getting public defenders because they don't have any money. I'm lost at how we balance the system out to make it more fair.
Well, we're all struggling with that since the Gideon versus Wainwright was decided decades ago. We're trying to figure out how to make that ruling significant and meaningful. But public defender systems struggle for lack of funding. But I can't imagine many jurisdictions where you would go out and campaign.
Yeah.
To be a better public defender, where that would be very popular, because the public sees the criminal as being the problem.
Yes.
So therefore, they would not likely vote for a person who says, I'm going to do a better job defending people.
But we talk about it all the time, of the number of people that get exonerated, commuted, blah, 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 for DNA, for the snitch thing that we talked about, where it was like a sixth of the people, were, maybe a quarter of the convictions were from snitch testimony that were released from DNA evidence. Like, there it appears to be a very large number of people that are at least not as guilty as they were convicted of, if not all the way completely innocent.
Oh, I'm expressing society's view personally. Yeah. I think that we should do a lot more in indigent defense across the land, but it's a tough sell because the public doesn't want to spend money with all the other things that are competing for public resources. That's not high on the average person's priority. Why don't you take a clipboard and go around Macon Mall, if there's anybody left in Macon Mall these days, and ask around who wants to put more money into public defender, and tell me which. We'll report that back in a couple of podcasts. How many people say yes?
I will do it. Actually, that neighborhood might not be that might not return so bad, because it's not the affluent neighborhood, so to speak.
I think it's pretty much a ghost town over there at Macon Mall nowadays.
It is because they made another mall up the road from it that scavenged all the patrons there. Well, all right then. So what I had said before was prison reform package backed by Ivy promises better rehabilitation and oversight. And this is coming from Alabama news kind of sources. Governor Kay Ivey has endorsed a package of criminal justice reform bills as a way to respond to the systemic problems within Alabama's prison systems. And this is Parchment. Was that was Alabama or is that Mississippi?
Yes, Mississippi.
Okay.
Alabama's Holman.
Okay. But probably similar. Not so bad as
Parchment. Very similar. Similar. There's been a number of deaths in the Alabama prison system over the last year or so that have been a result of inadequate resources for the prisons. And again, I don't condone prisoners killing one another, and I'm not saying that they're blameless. So people listening say, well, Larry, if you just understand that that's the convicts. But it's our job when we cage you and we take your ability away to defend yourself, it's our responsibility to see to it that we make the environment as safe as we can possibly do, knowing that people that are in there are some not very nice. That's our job to do that. If we're going to make you defenseless, we have to defend you.
So here's a situation that I encountered that I think is just a tip of the iceberg, but just exemplifies what happens when someone is released. If someone does some very short, and I'm not trying to say that, you know, hey, wuss, you didn't serve enough time. But if you serve any length of time, your driver's license is going to expire. And in my particular case, I was just past the window where my record was expunged, and I had to take the driver's test again. I had to actually like get in the car and do the turn signals and parallel park and all that garbage. So if you serve any length of time where that may happen, and they open the door and go, adios, good luck. Well, what kind of documentation do you have? Your family may have abandoned you along the way or passed away, whatever. You may be in a different state. And you have no documentation to support and prove who you are to get the ball rolling to do the next thing. Go get a job, get a driver's license, etc. So in here, the proposed package would do things like give people help people get a Social Security card, a birth certificate, and a non-driving photo ID prior to release. I mean, that is a super low barrier, a very high barrier, something pretty easy to do. But if you don't have anything, you need one of the forms of documents to get the other one, and you end up in this whole circle jerk of trying to get your Social Security card or birth certificate. You know, if you're 50 years old, how do you get your birth certificate again?
Very, very carefully. This is quite a package of different proposals, some sponsored by Republicans, some sponsored by Democrats. And the only thing that troubles me is that they want to, I like things I see in the package, but they're going to build new prisons. Now, is this going to be to retire the old obsolete prisons, or is this going to be to augment the overcrowded? Because Alabama has one of the most overcrowded systems that we have. I'm not as supportive if all we're going to do is continue to warehouse the same number of people. Mm-hmm. By building new prisons, because if you're 170% of capacity, you build three new ones and you bring yourself down to 110% of design capacity, that hasn't accomplished, it has accomplished something. It's made the extreme conditions less extreme. But I would like to see a proposal to actually divert people from prison, which toward the end of the proposal, there's looks like that there's a few hundred that might get out early under one of the proposals sponsored by one of the liberals.
Very strange, man. Very strange that other countries have figured these things out, but we could use their examples, but it seems to always be a race to the bottom of how shitty we can treat people.
Yeah, there's about 500 to 700 whose sentences could be reevaluated and shortened under one of the bills.
500?
And the sponsor said it to 700.
700?
They could have their 500 to 700. And he said it won't have a huge impact on reducing the prison population, but it's about creating fairness in Alabama's sentencing structure.
Yeah. All right, over back at the AP, two sheriffs sink voter okay to use inmate food money elsewhere. As I recall, 18 months ago, somewhere relatively early in our podcast history, Larry, we covered an article about a sheriff that had bought himself like a beach home from shaving dollars and pennies off of the food from the inmates of his county jail.
And it was this very same state we talked about.
They highlight, like, they just touch on that particular one. And it says that he bought a beach house, although auditors and ethics officials have found nothing illegal about what he did. So you feed the inmates cockroaches and Pop-Tarts, and then you get to buy a beach house.
And that's a problem because?
So I'm just trying to think that if you feed them halfway well, you would have less chance of riots. This is the same state with, no, this is Alabama. Never mind. I'm thinking of Mississippi again. They're interchangeable almost. But you would have people uprising because they're pissed off because the food sucks. And you're feeding them low amounts. So now you've got people robbing the people that are able to make store because their families do support them. It seems like this causes all kinds of problems. I'm not saying they need to be fed steak dinners and lobster and all that crap. I'm just saying, like, there's probably some basic standard that they should be met. And they're going to use this money to do other things.
Well, it begs the question from a policy perspective, though, when you look at a budget, people never understand budgeting because very few people have actually looked at a city or a county or a state, much less a federal budget. I'm one of those that can say that I have not looked at a federal budget. But if you look at it, if you look at even a relatively modest sized county, there's a lot of line items in the budget. And what happens to the funds at the end of the budget cycle is always an interesting concoction of whether there's a reversion to the general fund or whether it gets spent because of zero-based budgeting. If you don't spend it, we're going to cut your budget by that amount next year. And so the question becomes for the sheriff who does provide nutritious meals, who does keep the cost low, who does end up with money left over in the budget, what would happen? What's the incentive? We claim we want people in public service to treat it like a business and be efficient and run it like it would be a business. Okay, so we've got a sheriff who manages a department, doesn't buy brand new patrol cars every year, tries to hire deputies that don't hot ride them, tries to keep the line items from going over budget and keep them under. So the food service for the county lockup is one of the line items in the budget. What do we do with that money that's left over? If we want to have that incentive to stay within budget or come in under budget, what would happen with the funds that are left over?
Buy better food next go around, maybe.
So you prefer it be spent, the entire allocation?
The opposite of that seems to be that then they would intentionally try and shave the costs off the food to then create extra funding to move that money elsewhere intentionally, instead of it just being, well, we had more money than we fed them to the standards that we had set, and then with that money left over, we're intending to shave the money to buy new police cars.
Well,
I see that the incentive structure is backwards.
This is a request to divert it to school resource officers, mm-hmm, in this particular article. But what would we do with the money that's left over if you want, and I'm just playing to our conservative audience, if you want public officials to run their agencies with the intent of being frugal and not going over budget, but payment within a budget or with under budget, what would we do with the money that's left over each year if a person has done exactly what we say we would like them to do of our public servants? Where would those funds go that are left over?
I they shouldn't buy beach houses.
Well, we'd agree on that. They shouldn't buy beach houses, yes.
But they did, they found that there was nothing wrong with what that person did. So I'm just wondering, does that money then, is it allowed to be left in their bank account to handle any ups and downs? You know, we have gas prices that are fluctuating based on coronavirus, based on all these different factors. That would change the distribution cost of food so that they would have a buffer to handle the price variances.
So, well, if there's a surplus, state law permits 25% of it to go toward other law enforcement expenses, according to this article, if it's accurate.
Yeah.
So there's already the provision, since they changed to correct the abuse of the flagrant abuses we talked about a year and a half ago, or however long it was. They've now given them the prerogative to divert 20% of money. But this amendment would allow not 25%, but 100% to go.
Correct. Yep. So the amendment will allow Etowah County to use not just 25%. We could use 100%, the sheriff said. So. Again, that incentive, to me, is it incentivizes him to, you know, scrape the bottom of the barrel and add cockroaches into the food for extra protein, etc.
Well, you notice Marshall County, not only Marshall County Sheriff, said that the county has extra money in its jail food fund that can't be spent under the current state law. And he told WHNT-TV that he's hired a dietitian to make sure inmates get nutritious food, and he wouldn't pinch food costs to raise money for other purposes. They're inmates, I understand, but you have to take care of them. Now, if that's a serious, if that's his true feelings, and then the quote goes on to say they're still humans, and you still have to feed them, take care of them, but I'm just struggling with the balancing of what happens to well-managed public officials, because some public officials are very frugal managers. I see that in my work with mail that comes in with, for example, an extra ounce of postage when you go over the standard 1 ounce first class is only 15 cents, not 55 cents.
Right. Now put a second stamp on it.
And there's a lot of people who have no idea, and they'll put two stamps, so they pay $1.10 to mail something that would cost 50 plus 5 plus 15. And you can see that with the agencies where they actually use the correct amount, be it by meter or by putting the right amount of assembly of the right amount of stamps, because each additional ounce after the first ounce is only 15 cents. So what do we do to encourage them to not blow through their entire budget? And what do we do with the leftovers if they are frugal without dehumanizing the inmates? What would they do with those leftover funds?
I don't know. You're way smarter than me on this subject. I don't know how to balance all of those different sides of that, like, hexagon.
Well, often cases at the state level here, most things revert back to the general fund if it's unused. And agencies try their best not to have the money revert back to the general fund, but it does happen. It does happen where unspent funds revert back. And I don't know what would happen I'm guessing that the county appropriators, the commissioners, would probably appropriate less money for that line item if it wasn't needed to feed the prisoners, is what would happen. And most people don't want their budgets to shrink by line item.
Well, to move over to the pandemic of the day, which it's not a pandemic yet. I'm not trying to create fake news and people throw stuff at me. But so we have one from Forbes.com that says, handling coronavirus in federal prison. We have two articles back to back, another one from the PA Post, talking about from Pennsylvania that the coronavirus could be a big problem in Pennsylvania jails and prisons. You got people in close proximity. You have varying degrees of people's own sanitation. Also, the resources available, like some places don't let you take showers every day. Obviously, people are in super close proximity. This is a nightmare. This is a nightmare for the prison system if it does end up infecting a prison.
It would potentially be, and you covered that so well about prisons, you're totally, again, at the mercy of factors and forces beyond your control. You don't determine how fast and how hot the water runs. You don't determine this. I mean, to very little you say so over the stainless steel and what type of sanitizers they give you to keep the living area and the common things clean. You don't control what the other inmates do in terms of their own personal sanitation practices, if they practice anything at all. And so there's so many things beyond your control. And the nation of Iran they gave furloughs to a whole lot of people in prison. Thousands of them.
Really interesting. It was 50,000 if they were going to be released in the near future. They just said, well, good luck. And they could make parole or bond or something like that?
Yes.
That's an interesting solution.
But they wanted to try to minimize the impact if there were to be a spread of it and have fewer people infected. So rather than letting everybody loose, they figured if they diminish the overcrowding and make clearly, if you have a less crowded facility, you can do more containment. Overcrowding is an enemy for so many things because of the lack of the ability. The systems, even if they're working perfectly, when you're running a prison at 175% of design capacity, that's not optimal because everything is stressed that's running. They didn't design the laundry system, the ventilation system, the sanitation system, the plumbing, the food service. All that is not designed to handle that type of stress.
Let me,
that many people.
Yeah, let me throw this at you. You end up with people, you know, supporting an underground economy in prison where, hey, I want to get my laundry cleaned. I pay for someone to do my laundry separately. Well, that diminishes the resources for them to wash clothes for the general population, which I'm not saying coronavirus has spread through the laundry system, but now your clothes are getting less soap and things, cleaning materials, put in on them. Perhaps now you end up with someone with something that can be transmitted through washing clothes, whatever. And that stuff's not clean anymore. Or same thing with food, same thing with medicines. People sell medicines and stuff. Like, good grief. I mean, this is a perfect storm of problems.
Well, everything breaks down in overcrowding. I mean, the healthcare you have, or if you design a system to take care of 800 prisoners and you've got 1,300, you can't spread unless you bring in more healthcare workers. You've got the nursing staff, the medical staff, every segment of a prison is under immense stress when they go substantially above what they're designed. And in fact, most corrections experts will tell you that you don't want to run a system anywhere near the design capacity, because again, everything stresses at that level. When you're running a prison at 100% capacity, ideally you don't want to be running a prison at capacity, but that's hard to do with our lock 'em up mentality in this country. So we potentially are going to have a problem. And that was the only point of putting this in here, because mm-hmm. these people are more vulnerable than the rest of us are. And they have nothing they can really do to help themselves. Very little they can do.
To then expand on that, you would also end up with the guards. You know, they're not super well paid. Maybe, you know, they only have a limited number of days of vacation. And if they get sick and they call in sick, that puts more stress on the ones that are still coming in, putting them potentially at higher risk of catching whatever it is or burning out, and then the prison being understaffed, and then you end up with parchment.
That is correct. All sorts of problems, potential with this. And I don't know what the Centers for Disease Control and what plans are being made for prisons, but hopefully they figure out some containment measures.
You know what, Larry? I have the ultimate solution to this problem.
What would that be?
The solution to this problem is they should have thought about that before they did their crime.
I don't know how you would think about that. No one had ever heard of this. So, but.
I'm laughing just because it's so outrageous and just so ridiculous. It's just over the top that we, anyway. All right, we should move on. We should move on to an article from Crescent News. Ohio Sex Offender Registry needs to stay? This article can't be legit and real. Ohio Sex Offender Registry currently has 18,000, almost 1,900 offenders who have been convicted of various levels of sex crimes. And this individual, this author, thinks that it should stay?
Well, I guess this author has their opinion.
I imagine that this is almost like on the heels of the Michigan decision. That this has got to be in response to that.
I take it that you don't fully agree with this article.
I'm pretty sure I don't agree with it. Yeah, right on the face, just from the title. I can come up with all kinds of problems for various degrees of who's on the registry for what. But even 19,000, that's fewer than Georgia has. I don't know what the average is, but that's still a pretty big number of people that you would try to manage to then figure out who the actual, potentially who the people are that would need to be monitored.
Well, Narsil had a reaction to that article that went out as well, and it was published, as I understand it.
And I assume Narsil's position was, this is garbage and registries need to go?
That would be correct. That was actually the title of the article, "Why Registries Need to Go."
I didn't see the article. Where was it published?
Well, it would be on our website.
I see where it is. It was published in the Portsmouth Daily. I will add that to the show notes now.
So Sandy, our communications director, wrote that.
Okay. And obviously she was of the opinion that they need to go.
I thought it was a well-written, reasoned response.
Of course. Hey, there's also a response down there from one of our patrons named Will. I didn't get a chance to read that, though. It's a pretty, his response is pretty lengthy. But it just starts out, it says, the author has chosen to willingly ignore the evidence that proves several facts, and then he goes on from there. So that's Will for you.
My computer has frozen. Is that good?
Say that again?
I said my computer has frozen. Is that a good thing?
No, that's definitely not a good thing. I mean, you've dropped out a few times tonight, so I would possibly call that par for the course.
Mm-hmm. So we're almost done with the podcast. Yeah, so you'll have to read all the information we do at the end, but once we hear from Scalia.
I can do that. So we can do the second Scalia clip now. And here we go.
This is Scalia on Doma. I probably ought to set up this. That this Please. Is because people are going to say, why did we talk about the Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA? And the reason why we did that is because oftentimes the Supreme Court is vilified and accused of doing something they didn't do. And this is an example of what DOMA, what the decision, what was that, 15 or 60, whatever year that was, of what actually the court struck down. But they didn't create this, all this fear that was instilled into what was going to happen. And Scalia explains it best. So that's why I prefer to hear it from him versus me.
Very good. Well, here is Scalia on DOMA.
How's the recent Supreme Court ruling on DOMA going to impact the church vis-a-vis mandatory performance of weddings?
Technically that ruling has nothing to do with the issue of whether the states or the churches have to honor single-sex marriages. It has nothing to do with that. It just deals with when federal statutes refer to marriage, what does that refer to? DOMA simply said that in federal statute it refers only to marriage between a man and a woman. And DOMA said, no, that's wrong. It now refers to whatever unions were lawful under the state that concluded them. It has nothing to do with whether the states must recognize same-sex marriage, although, as I said in my dissent in the case, that's the shoe that will next drop. I mean, I think it's coming, but DOMA doesn't do it.
So what he's describing is that me and my boyfriend want to get married, and I go to my local church and say, I demand that you marry me and my boyfriend, and the federal law for DOMA now says that they have to marry us.
No, that's not what the case stood for. The issue of was the Defense of Marriage Act came about because the president at the time was more liberal than what society was ready for. We had a president who thought that gays should be able to serve in the military, and they instituted the don't ask, don't tell policy. And a few states had started allowing same-sex marriage. So the conservatives in Congress at the time said, well, by golly, we can't have that because first thing you know, marriage as an institution is going to be destroyed. So these states that are choosing to marry same-sex people, we need to intervene with federal law. And they passed the Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, which is what Scalia is talking about. And they said that for federal purposes, a marriage is defined as a union between a man and a woman, which meant that states like New York and whatever a list of states were at that time that had said that same-sex marriage were okay, it meant that people that had those very valid marriage licenses issued by those states could not go into the Social Security office and collect their spousal benefits because those marriages for federal purposes weren't recognized. So anything that had a federal component, you couldn't get it because your marriage was not legitimate thanks to DOMA. So all this did was said marriage belongs in the proper domain of the states. They get to regulate and decide who gets married within a state, and it threw it back to the states, which is what conservatives claim they believe in all along. So that's what always puzzled me. Why did they want to usurp the state's power to prohibit a state that wanted to allow same-sex marriage? Why did they want so desperately? And of course, I know what the answer is. Well, Larry, you have to understand that the sacred sanctimony of marriage is so important that if you go down that road that two people of the same sex can get married, next thing you know, it'll be multiple partners. And what are we going to marry next? I mean, it's just a slippery slope to the moral decay of society. That's their answer. But I thought that that was up to the locals of the states to decide that. That's what they profess. They believe so strongly in is local control.
Does that at all move over to the Masterpiece Cake Shop? Is that the right? Is that even remotely related?
You talk about the having to prepare the cake.
Correct.
Yes. Well, I suppose in a way, you get into public accommodations, and the question on that case was whether or not going to have a cake made for you as a public accommodation, similar to a hotel room or to housing, if there's a protection, a right that you have under law to be protected, and that's a whole program component that I don't know if we want to get into tonight about the cake. I don't know why you'd want to have a cake baked for or you, if somebody who didn't want your money. I kind of like to spend my money with people who want it.
A completely
I can understand the logic if you go in and say, they say, we don't serve your kind here. And you think that it's something that's open to the public, you would find that very disheartening. It would be like if you called the taxi cab company and they said, you sound like you have an accent. We don't like your kind. We will not dispatch to you. You would not find it. And I asked people when they said that they wanted to, the people who were against how the courts are coming down on this cake thing, when they say it's interfering with their religious freedom, I ask them, are you going to be okay with this? Make sure you understand what you're promoting. Are you going to be okay when someone from a fundamentalist Middle Eastern religion who believes that a female has to be escorted by a male or be married, when they show up at a hotel in the United States of America who happens to be operated by a Middle Easterner who has that core belief, and they say, no, madam, we do not rent to you here because you are not accompanied. Are you going to be okay with that as the protection of their religious views? And most people say no. And I said, well, I don't understand it. You say that we have to protect the Christianity, that if it goes against their Christian beliefs, they still have to bake the cake for the same-sex couple, but yet you're willing to do a flip-flop just right on the dime when it comes to a religious belief that you don't agree with, and you don't want to protect their religious beliefs. Why is it that your beliefs are so much more important to be protected? And I have not gotten an answer to that one either.
All right, so there is Scalia. And what was your ultimate intent on that particular clip?
The sensationalism of what people scare folks about, the hype about the clergy were going to be forced. You're not forced to marry a soul that you don't want to marry. That didn't have anything to do with who has to marry anybody.
Okay. And then by extension, I can't remember which state it was, Kentucky, Tennessee. There was a woman that worked at the county clerk, and she refused to do marriage certificates for same sex. That would fall under county this, clerk. Correct?
Well, according to Scalia, it didn't. She was a duly elected county clerk, who's supposed to issue marriage licenses, and she refused to issue the license, and she got held in contempt, and she actually got jailed for a few days. And presidential candidate Michael Huckabee ran down to parade around and tout her release when she was released, that was a ceremonial thing. You don't have to agree with there are things that you do in government that's a ceremonial requirement that you have to do. And sorry, that's a part of going with the office. when people are legally entitled to get married, whether you appreciate their marriage or approve it or not, that's your job to issue the license.
Brenda in chat says Rowan County, Kentucky. How about that?
Yep.
And she just pulled it out as if it was like magic.
Mm-hmm. That was her hometown, probably.
I wasn't going to call her out for that one. We received a comment from a listener regarding episode 117, which was One Step Back. And this is from Will, but not that Will. It's a different Will. It says, hey, hello. Thank you for your work. I wish I could listen to more, but there's only so much time. Totally, I understand. That is the biggest problem with fighting the registries. I listened to about an hour of the podcast. I'd like to thank you, Narsal, and everyone else fighting, especially when no one has to do it. I know other sheriffs in Georgia are doing exactly what Cobb County is doing. That's referencing to what we talked about with them harassing people at all hours of the night, basically. They are operating outside of the law. For example, the law is clear about what information people are forced to give to them at the point of a gun, of course, but these sheriffs are too incompetent, arrogant, or simply to just follow that. Excuse me. All of them request more and suggest it is required. That is just not messing around. That is operating outside of the law. The person on the podcast, named Larry, sounds great and obviously well-informed. Go you, Larry. I would like to suggest to him that others, I would like to suggest to him and others that though he calls them, do not call them registrants offenders. I think you, Narsal, and everyone else should call them a registrant, a person forced to register, PFR. Much more accurate. I totally just wanted to get your opinion on how we term our people.
Yeah, I wish we could come up with that magic. I hear that all the time. I mean, you're trying to figure out a way to describe a person because no one chooses to register that I'm aware of. So it's not like a voluntary act that you're engaging in. But it's kind of like a prisoner. When you're in prison, you are an inmate or a prisoner. And when you're forced to register, I mean, you are a registrant. But yeah, I wish I had the answer to a magic description. I know people struggle with that all the time.
And then he continues. He says, also, PFRs need to get over trying to hide. The podcast suggested that PFRs did not allow law enforcement to come onto their property and then sign their papers that they might visit their neighbors. People need to get over that and encourage it. Personally, I'd be completely happy if law enforcement never came near me and they can harass my neighbors about me as much as they like. I've got no concern or issue with simply ignoring anyone that is a problem. The registries long ago changed me into a person who couldn't care less what other people think. Personally, I encouraged PFRs to never allow law enforcement to get near them. Put fencing or walls around your property and keep them out. They are a danger. I'm not necessarily sure I disagree with that final sentiment there. I'm not sure how practical it is, though.
Well, putting fencing around is not an option for people who live in multifamily housing, and it's not an option for people who have economic challenges. But I get where he's coming from. But saying you don't care about them talking to your neighbors is a scary thing, because if they only spoke the truth to your neighbors, that would be one thing. But the way they cast when they go talk to your neighbors because you've been insubordinate with them, they don't go talk to the neighbors in a neutral tone. They go talk to the neighbors and say, have you heard from this guy? You see his picture here? We haven't been able to get in touch with him. We're kind of concerned about him. Oh, yeah, well, what did he do that makes you? Well, he's on the sex offender registry, right? Well, what did he do? Well, he abused a 13-year-old. Oh, really? Well, of course, that person has a house full of kids, and then there's a house full of kids next door. And then they go on and on about they had him a special card and say, you call us if you see this person, because we haven't been able to make contact with him, and we're kind of concerned. Well, what is your neighbor, how they're going to react to that when they see you the next time? They didn't know that you were on the sex offender registry necessarily. They didn't know that the crime involved a 13-year-old necessarily, and they've just been suggested to them that you're trying to avoid and evade law enforcement, and the average person doesn't understand that your obligations are only to come in once a year, generally in Georgia, for example. They don't understand all that. So all of a sudden, your neighbor has a paranoia that's been created by law enforcement going to the neighbor's door. That's what I was trying to convey to people, but if you have absolutely no fear that the law enforcement can do anything that will harm you, then more power to you. But I have great fear for what law enforcement can do and what they can do in terms of how the neighbors perceive you and how the neighbors react to you.
You know what? I think now I can actually play this clip. I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to use this tonight, but I'm going to I think this will highlight exactly what you're saying.
I got my rights to do anything I want to do. I'm a police officer.
They can do whatever they want, man. They got their rights.
So, but I really appreciate where he's coming from on in terms of, I wish people pushed back a little bit more, but I'm really leery of suggesting how much and where, because of the consequences that can cascade that I'm not in a position to help with. And that's why I'm very hesitant to tell people don't do this or do that. I tell them that I can only speak for myself in terms of what I would try to do under the circumstances. And you don't even know that you would be able to do that. You don't know how, when they show up, what type of mood, what your mental state's going to be, and how you're going to react when the Gestapo, when you open the door and there's guns. I mean, you just truly don't know how you're going to react. It's a situation where you wish you would be able to react, but you don't know.
Let me tell you something that is super exciting, Larry, is when we get a new patron, and we have a new patron named Steamy Minty, and I have a special sound for that one. How about that? And then one of our patrons increased their the level of support, and I supremely thank you, Mac, for doing that increase. Thank you very much to all of our patrons and all of our listeners.
Thank you, Mac and Steamy.
Yep. Larry, that's all I got, man. Is there anything else you wanted to cover before we get out of here?
Well, I appreciate everybody so much. I want to get an email when we get an email like what someone said. That's very touching, because we actually do put work into trying to be helpful and provide people information. And we didn't have a lot of really, really solid stuff tonight that would relate to any earth-shattering litigation. But hopefully these little tidbits were helpful all across the board in terms of understanding the courts and understanding politics and understanding systems. Even though we didn't have any great case of importance to talk about.
Very good. Humble brag there, Larry.
Well, that's what we hope that people do when they hear these things. I mean, very few people think about budgets and leftovers.
I don't think people think about budgeting their own personal money, let alone what the government does with budgeting.
Yeah. So understanding that a public defender is going to have somebody to report to, and that there's going to be accountability, and that someone's going to ultimately be able to hire and fire a chief public defender. I mean, the average person wouldn't think about that.
Never. Larry, what's the website where people can find this wonderful podcast?
Oh, I don't know, but I think it's patreon.com.
Oh, yes.
Oh, no,
go straight there, man.
CO. .co, not com.
How about registrymatters.co?
Yeah, no, Patreon. I'm getting to the part of the money.
I know.
Registrymatters.co.
Yeah,
I want the money. All about the money.
All the benefits.
So registrymatters.co. That's what it is.
And of course, you're going to remember the phone number because you had to announce it 45 times during the NARSAW call on Monday night.
Oh, you're talking about the 747?
That's the one.
That one? 227-4477. That's 747-227-4477.
And then our email is registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And lastly, Larry, how do people support us?
Well, they go to Registry Matters and they look at what their bank balance is and they just clean it out completely.
Perfect. At patreon.com/registrymatters.
Nobody's done that yet.
Nobody's done that yet. I think someone did do their net because they were unemployed and it was like a dollar or whatever. Gross net. I always get those things backwards. Anything else, Larry, before we go?
That's it, Andy. Thanks, everyone.
All right. Take care. Good night.
Good night.